Hey everyone, on this week's episode I'm joined by the 1999-2000 Vezina Trophy winner Olaf Kolzig. This Washington Capitals legend racked up over 300 wins during his NHL career, along with two All-Star nominations in the King Clancy Trophy in 2006. Ole the Goalie won the Calder Cup in 1994 with the AHL's Portland Pirates and appeared twice for Germany in the Olympics. He also fought the best man in his wedding, which you'll hear all about in this episode. Really, one of my heroes growing up as a goaltender, Olaf Kolzig, born in South Africa. You went to Canada, to the United States. You played hockey in Tri-City and Juniors, and you're actually German. It's such an interesting story, and maybe you could fill us in on the background of how you got to junior hockey and all these moves that you made as a child before you got there.
Yeah, so a good buddy of mine in Florida dubbed me Germafricadian, which kind of covers all the countries that I have some sort of contact with. And my parents are from Germany, and they both once they left university, they both got into the hotel industry, and they started in Johannesburg. They were married down there, and then shortly after I was born, because he was in the hotel business, and he got transferred around quite a bit, spent a few stops in Europe before coming to Canada when I was 4 years old. And that's when I got introduced to the game. It was in Edmonton, you know, back then you played in a lot of outdoor rinks. And so the first time I got introduced to being a goaltender, I had a kid come down on me on a breakaway, and I was so petrified to get hit by the puck in minus 30 degree weather that I actually hid behind the net. So that was nobody ever foresaw me becoming an NHL goaltender that had a fairly lengthy pro career. But I spent a little bit of time in Edmonton before moving up to the Northwest Territories for a year. We then moved to Toronto, probably 4 or 5 years there, and then we moved to Nova Scotia, and that's really where I got a little bit more serious with the game. In a very good midget team. We went to the national championship 1 year. I was scouted by, at the time was New Westminster of the Western Hockey League. And so they put me on their protected list. Shortly after that happened, I moved actually out to British Columbia. My dad, again, different hotel. Spent the first year up and down in between Junior A and the Western League. After that season, our owner decided to move the team down to Tri-Cities in Washington State. Nobody at the time understood why. I mean, it was in the middle of the desert, and we were leaving a very respected community in New West and a lot of history in the WHL. So it was a little bizarre, but. We came down and we were treated like rock stars. We 6,000 seat arena is full every night for 2 years. We played the first 17 games of our first year on the road because our building hadn't been finished yet. Fans would be cheering the Zamboni driver when he came on the ice. It was just, they were naive to the game, but it was a new form of entertainment for them. And we just fell in love with the city, and the city fell in love with us. And it's just a great relationship. And, that's why I still, I guess I call it home now. I live out here. So, played that first full year here in Tri-Cities, and I got drafted in 89 by the Washington Capitals, and, made the team right out of my first training camp. We were the first NHL team to go to Russia, along with Calgary. Myself, Byron Defoe, another former goalie, we were both the two top picks that year for the Caps, and they took us both over to Russia for that trip. I had a fantastic training camp, and really I had no expectations going into camp. I just wanted to make a mark and, knew I was going back to junior, and so as a result, you play stress-free, pressure-free, and I had a great training camp and made the team and stuck with the Caps for the first 6 weeks, I guess, into that NHL season before getting sent back to Tri-Cities. And then it probably took me another Well, I'd say 4 or 5 years before I finally established myself again as an NHL goalie. Came back to Tri-Cities not with bad attitude, just the wrong attitude. I thought to myself that, I made the NHL my first year of training camp. Coming back to junior, I should be able to dominate down here. Well, you don't realize that when you're playing in the NHL, you've got five players playing in front of you that do their job extremely well. The defense know what they're doing, the forwards know what they're doing. Come back to junior, and it's not like that. So, anyway, needless to say, I struggled. Took a while to get my confidence back, get my game back, and then in '97, I finally got my first starting job. And as a result, it's almost like, we talked about earlier about you getting your first taste of the NHL due to my injury in Tampa. Well, I finally got the number one spot in Washington because Billy Ranford had gotten injured in the first game of the season, and I never looked back. We went to the Stanley Cup Finals that year, lost to Detroit, unfortunately. But for me, obviously, it was my breakout season, and I had another 13, 14 years of NHL hockey after that. So, yeah, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of memorable moments, but obviously, it's something that I'll always treasure.
It's unbelievable that you spent the better part of your career, I don't know whether it was 13, 14 years, I haven't added them up here in Washington, and you did all this moving around before you got there, whether it was through the minors as a kid, even junior a little bit, you're in Nova Scotia, end up in the Western League, you're all over the place. So it must have been nice to have that in Washington for all those years. And you kind of went through your process of getting there, and we glossed over a little bit of it. And I'd like to go back even to Tri-City for a brief bit, which you're now part owner of. And I noticed though that during the time you were there, one, you had a lot of penalty minutes and you also scored a goal. And aside from your play as a goaltender, which carried you through, tell me what it was like playing in that league back then. This is 88, 89, 90. Was it a lot different than it is nowadays?
Oh yeah. It's just like, it's like the East Coast League or the American League back 30 years ago. It was a lot. I mean, it had a little bit of slapshot in it. You had to, as a player, you had to be accountable. You had to stand up for yourself. I think it was a lot more physical. Just definitely wasn't as fast as it is now. The skill level wasn't nearly what it is now. But yeah, back then, one of my idols growing up was Ron Hextall. And he was a big, tall guy, and so was I. And I had a fiery temper, just like he did. And so, I think my last year midget really started to handle the puck. Because back then, puck handling goaltenders were non-existent. They were like unicorns. They were non-existent. You had the odd one, and obviously Hextall was the best at the time. And so I wanted to kind of model my game after him. And so I became a very good puck handler, and like I said, a little bit of a temper. So if anybody, got under my skin or bumped me in the crease, I would take a slashing penalty or roughing or tripping or so the penalty minutes added up. Coaches weren't too happy about that, but as long as I did my job and killed off the penalty, they were okay with it. And so the year that I got back, sent back from Washington, it was in late November. We were playing the Seattle Thunderbirds, and in the game, I had gotten a penalty already, and I got an assist. So we had a 2-goal lead. It's probably about a minute left in the game, and Seattle dumped the puck in. It was a delayed offside, so it gave me plenty of time to get behind the net, corral the puck, look up ice, and take a shot. And I'd love to say that I lofted it 30 feet in the air and it landed flat and went right in the middle of the net. But the truth was, I got it about 2 feet off the ice, and one of my forwards actually had to lift his leg to let the puck get by him, and it just spun and just barely got inside the left post to make it 5-2. And it was unbelievable. The bench cleared. It was like we just scored an overtime of a game seven. And that was probably the best game I'd played once I got back from Washington. So it was long overdue, but I was so excited. The next day, I got a call from Jack Button, who was the director of player personnel with Washington, and thinking I'm getting a congratulatory call. And he's like, "So I heard he had a pretty good game last night. Scored a goal, got an assist." And I said, "Yeah, Jack, it was unbelievable. The bench cleared. It was the best feeling ever." And he kind of put me in my place and paused for a second and said, "Well, you know, the last time we checked, we drafted you to stop the puck and not try and score goals. And you have not done a very good job of it." And I tell you what, I don't know if I handled the puck the rest of the season. I stayed in my crease and just focused on trying to stop the puck. Jack had that kind of an influence on me. Not to say that it made my year any better, but he definitely put things back into perspective and got me focused back on doing what I was supposed to be doing.
Talk about a shot across the bow. I mean, I scored one in juniors too.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
a highlight of my life at the time. Same thing you're talking about. And then the next moment you get that phone call. I mean, you were a 19th overall pick though to the Capitals. They had really high expectations for you, obviously. And coming out of junior, you ended up playing that next season, 90-91, half of it in the ECHL for the Hampton Roads Admirals. Was that a big blow to your ego, or did you take it in stride and were you able to take that and move forward with it and growing your game and getting acclimated to professional hockey?
Yeah, so no, it totally was a blow to my ego because I'd made the Caps training camp the year before, and you know, but knowing now, being on the other side of the door in management, you realize that the team has a plan for you. They're not sending you somewhere because they want to punish you. You need to play. And that year I was not going to play a lot in Baltimore. We had, you know, we had Sean Simpson, who was third round pick, played for World Junior team. Jim Rivnak was a coveted college player who ended up having a very solid pro career. Don Beaupre was at the peak of his career. So there was a lot of depth there. And I think they ended up trading for Mike Liut. And so I went down at first with a bit of a chip on my shoulder, a little upset, but you know, once I got there and got to know the area, very, very nice area, new teammates. John Brophy was our coach. So that was a little intimidating too at first. Here's that I watched growing up, you know, on the bench for the Toronto Maple Leafs, you know, snow white hair, and when he got mad, his face would almost turn purple. And
he's wearing a bolo tie,
you know,
he always had on.
Where's the bolo tie, right? Like, so you're just like, oh my God, where, you know, this is slap shot.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, at that time, that's kind of what was spinning in my head. And I remember the first game at home, I gave up a goal from center ice. First home game. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is going to be hell. So we get in the dressing room between periods, and I'm just waiting to hear it from Brof, and he comes in, and he gave the forward crap for not tying up the player that shot the puck. Didn't even look at me from the red line, right? I'm like, okay. Anyway, so come to find out, Brof was a guy who he understood the game. There's mistakes in games, and what he wanted was a guy that cared, a guy that worked, and would show up for his teammates. And, you know, I'd been there for probably 3 weeks before this was my first home game. I played a couple games on the road, but so he'd already built up a lot of respect for me just because of. Maybe internally I didn't feel like I belonged there, but I didn't show it externally. You know, I worked hard. You know, I showed that I cared. I wanted to be there. And so after that happened, it really just sort of like, okay, you know, you've got away with one here. You know, let's start focusing on what you're here for, is to get better, play a lot of games. And ended up having a pretty good season. I blew out my shoulder. Oh God, probably near the end of the season and was in and out of the lineup during the playoffs. Basically sat from the press box to watch us win, you know, the Kelly Cup at the time, but just being there and being part of that winning atmosphere. And, you know, anytime you win a championship with a group of guys, those guys are, they're special, and they'll always have a special place in your heart, and you'll always have that special bond. So, after that year, I knew I had a ways to go. I knew I had a ways to go, and for me, it was a lot. Was it between my ears? And like I told you earlier, when I went to Washington for my first training camp, I didn't have any expectations. 19-year-old goalie is not going to make the NHL's first camp. So I was already resigned to the fact I was going back to junior, and I just went in carefree. Well, now I'm a pro, and now, there's no getting sent back. Like, this is your livelihood. And so I would get too high and too low, too mad when we lost games, too, pissed off when I gave up a bad goal. And so it took me a few years to finally become mentally strong enough to play the position at the pro level. And then once that happened, then I really started to make a lot of gains. I got loaned out to Rochester the next year because Byron Defoe was coming in for his first year pro, and they wanted him in Baltimore so that they could, oversee him day in and day out. This is my second year pro, so they felt that, I was strong enough mentally to go to a different organization. But again, now I'm thinking, okay, now, I played half the year last year on the coast. They're done with me already. And this is my second year pro, and I'm thinking the organization's already given up on me. And like I said, you don't realize they have a master plan. So I go to Rochester with a chip on my shoulder. And I said to myself, listen, just play for yourself, make an impression in Rochester. Who knows, maybe the Sabres will sign you the next year. And so I ended up having a career year. We went to the Calder Cup Finals. We lost to Cape Breton, but we upset the Binghamton Rangers, and they were the team back then. I think it was 91, 92. They broke every American League hockey record, fewest games lost, most points, yada yada yada, and we ended up beating them 7 games. So it was a very successful season for me. I came out of that season, and when we were talking contract with the Caps, I had a serious interest from Buffalo and Boston, and they asked me, what is it going to take to keep you here? And my agent just threw it out there, said he needs a one-way contract. And I ended up getting a one-way contract out of the deal. But for me, like I said, the biggest hurdle was the mental part. And then after that, there were some other things that kind of kept me from being a full-time number one guy. Timing being a lot. Then next year, here I am signing the big, the one-way contract, which, back in the early 90s isn't the one-way contract that guys are getting nowadays. But still, it was significant for that time. And so we go into the next season, and we have a lockout. I think it's 94 season, 93, 94 season. We have a lockout. So I miss the first half of that season. And, I just come out here. I came back to Tri-Cities and skated with the junior team, and just tried to stay in shape as well, as good as I could. And then that was the first year that Jim Carrey came out of Wisconsin.
Ace.
And he was another draft pick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ace. Yeah. And he was another draft pick of the Caps. And so, while I'm sitting on the sidelines during this lockout, Byron and Ace are both playing in Portland, and Ace just got shot out of a cannon. I think he came in and, won 14 in a row or something, just set all these American League records for a rookie. And so anyway, the lockout ends early January. So we all come back. We have, like, I don't know, 7, 8 day training camp, and the season starts. Well, it was Rick Tabarachi and I are the goalies that year. And between the two of us, I don't think we won a game for the first 10. So with the success that Ace was having down in Portland, they decided to call him up.
So they flipped you guys out and you went back to Portland for that year.
Well, they had three of us for a while, and then Tabby got traded to Calgary. But so Ace comes up, and you couldn't, myself, I couldn't be like, I wasn't discouraged or upset at the time, because, hey, I got an opportunity, and I didn't take a hold of it. Like, I was given a chance to be a number one guy, or at least, to be a full-time NHL guy, and I just didn't take full advantage of it. So Ace comes up, he plays great. I think we ended up making the playoffs that year in Washington. I ended up going back down to Portland for a little bit for conditioning, and I came back up at the end of the year. We made the playoffs, and Ace struggled. That was Ace's biggest thing, is that he struggled in the playoffs. That was the first year that we played Pittsburgh. In my era, it was the first time we played Pittsburgh, and Ace struggled. I think he got yanked. I think I yanked both times, game one and two.
How do you end up with the Ace nickname? Do you know who gave it to him? I mean, I know it comes from Jim Carrey,
Yeah.
Ace Ventura, but who gave it to him? Because that's an unbelievable nickname.
I honestly, I think it was me. I just
You
called him
labeled him.
Ace. Well, it was, because, I mean, Jim Carrey, right? Like, Ace Ventura. And The Mask, right? He played in The Mask. So it was kind of the same thing. And,
Did he go along with it? Did he enjoy it?
oh yeah, he enjoyed it. And you know what? And I can honestly say I got along great with Ace, and he was a really good teammate. The only thing is, I don't know if he really. I think he just wanted to make enough money in the game and then retire. Like, I don't think he was really passionate about the game of hockey like a lot of players are, and that frustrated me because, here's this kid who's got all this talent, is playing great, and I don't know, just maybe wasn't as. I knew for sure he wasn't as passionate about it as I was, but. He was finding a way to have success, and I wasn't, and it just drove me crazy.
Yeah, but it's really hard to sustain the success if you don't have that drive. I mean, I was the same way with that it would drive me crazy when I'd see goalie partners out there dogging it in practice, because I was just driven. Like I'd so the only way I knew how to practice from, I guess, from like college is really when I figured it out that I had to absolutely send it every day in practice to just get a chance to get in the net. And I couldn't stand watching somebody not work as hard as they should be.
Well, exactly. And then, like you said, it eventually it catches up to the player, right? And so as a result, Ace didn't have nearly the length of career that he should have had. And I try to tell the young guys that now. It's hey, you might not be getting what you want right now, but be persistent, keep working, because eventually good things happen to good people. People that want it the most, it's usually going to work out for them.
You've kind of come full circle with some of the coaches you've had in some instances here, because I look back to that Rochester team that you got loaned out to. You met Mitch Korn. He's a goalie coach there. You guys got to work together again in Washington. Barry Trotz, you had at several places. You had him, I believe, in Baltimore and then again in Portland. Can you just tell me a little bit about the relationship you had with those two guys?
Well, Trotsky even goes further back than that. Trotsky was Washington's Western League scout when I was playing, and he's the one that actually scouted me. So Trotsky and I have had a relationship ever since day one, and he got into the coaching side of it and was in Baltimore. I didn't play for him a ton in Baltimore because that's when I got loaned out to Rochester, but I played for him the year after because we connected again in Portland. And we ended up winning the Calder Cup that year.
Right. There was a great
So
graphic. There's a great graphic from that actually, that you were the last goaltender to go to the Calder Cup finals for two different teams. I guess what, 93 and then 94. And then I did it 2 years ago between Syracuse and Texas. And so the American League had that graphic. And I just thought that was really cool because, us being teammates, at least for that little bit of time and that parallel. But thankfully for
right.
you won the thing though. I didn't win in either of them, so I've been the bridesmaid twice.
Yeah, well, you need to have the horses in front of you.
Yeah. Well, we were pretty good, man. It just didn't pull it off in time. But what was it like with Mitch Korn in 19? Like, give me a window into Mitch Korn 1993. Back then, when he was just green and getting his feet wet, what was he like to work with?
He was, I mean, a lot like he is today. He hasn't changed a lot, other than he doesn't wear those Coke bottle glasses anymore.
LASIK was really good to him.
But he was, one of the first goalie coaches that came out, and used all these different gadgets. A lot like golf instructors do now, where they come out, they bring out all these toys that somehow work for the golf swing. Well, Mitch had that for goalies. There was just a, and for me, it was really the first time that I had like a serious goaltending coach. And he obviously was working for Buffalo, but he came down to Rochester, and he was just as good working with me as he was with Billy Pye, who was my partner at the time and a Buffalo draft pick. And and Mitch, I think Mitch helped a little bit in getting me to be more, how can I say it? I guess mentally tougher, because he was tough. He didn't baby you in practice. Like if you were dogging it, he'd give it to you. If you were, not doing the drill right, he'd give it to you. But he'd also give, he was a fair guy. Like he'd give you, but he'd give you praise if you're doing things well. So I had a great relationship with Mitch, and I had one ever since. And then obviously, we get together, we're working together in Washington again. So what he's done with the goalies that he's had is really remarkable. He turned Braden Holtby into a Vezina winner. Robin Leonard was a finalist and had an unbelievable year. So no matter where Mitch goes, he has an impact.
Something about you that when I was talking with people, knowing you were coming on, we talked about was that obviously you're a big guy, 6'4", 225, I guess is what I think you're listed as, but
Well, yeah, I haven't been 220. I haven't been 225 and since I retired.
yeah, but at your playing weight, right? But you
Yeah,
always
that
look
was my
big.
playing weight.
You always look big in the net, and I don't mean just your sheer size. It seemed like the way you wore your equipment really aided in that. And I'm curious if that's something that you really worked on, or if it's just purely by chance that your gear worked for you that well, because correct me if I'm wrong here too, like you were a Heaton CCM guy, I think your entire career. So were you really big into your gear, or was that just kind of by chance?
I wasn't as nitpicky about my gear as some guys that I play with are. And I really didn't wear, when I think when I played with you in Tampa, I might have been the first time I went to a Coho chest protector, or chest and arm. It was the gold and black one. I'm trying to remember the model number, but that was really the first one that was big and bulky. And I don't know why. Maybe I figured, geez, I'm almost 40 years old, trying to give myself a little bit of an advantage. I don't know, but I hated it. So for the most of my career, I wore actually gear. If I was supposed to wear an XL, I would have worn L. I just felt like I moved around the net more. My pads, I wore, God, what I wear, 36s, and I probably should have been wearing 38s. But again, I didn't want to go as small as Marty Brodeur. It looked like he's wearing catalogs on his shins, but I didn't want to look like Manny Legace either with my pads coming up to
Right.
my waistline. So it, for me, I felt I was big enough, and I just wanted movement. I wanted to be able to move. My game was obviously wasn't a speed-induced game. Mine was more strategic and use my size to force guys either hit me or miss the net. But I felt like I was athletic and agile enough to get east-west if I needed to. And back in my heyday, it was a different game. The D could clutch and grab and tie up, and so as a goaltender, if you're facing a 2-on-1 or in any sort of odd man rush, that your D man's going to be all over the backdoor guy. And for me, with my size, I could just challenge the shooter, and more times than not, he's either going to miss me, hit the post, or I get the save on it. So I see guys, and I've seen guys, like Dominic Hasek, and I've seen, what's his name in New York?
Lundqvist.
Henrik.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see them out of their equipment, and you're like, how are these guys athletes? Like, how they should be, they should be like jockeys on a horse. They're so slight and small. But then when you see them in the net, it's like, how could they be as big as me? Like, how is Hank's shoulders that big? And how did Hasek look so big in the net? And, they enjoyed wearing the bigger gear.
To be totally honest, man, I'm really surprised at the longevity you had in your career and not being, it didn't seem to beat your body up for as quite frankly, as big as you are. You're built big shoulders, big frame, but you played tons of games. Every year as a starter, you're plus 60 games, 70 games, so it didn't really factor in much with you, which is pretty amazing because now bigger guys really beat it up so hard when they're young that you're seeing hip, knee problems. I want to know, though, what you think the biggest changes were for you that you had to make from the time you became a pro until 2009. I mean, that's almost 20 years, and the game changed so much. And your era, especially, I think of you and Sean Burke and Manny Legace and other people that played during this time frame, how much their game evolved and progressed. So, what did you think the biggest changes were that you had to make?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, when you first in 80, 89, when I got drafted and you did your your testing and you got your workout from the strength conditioning guy. There wasn't a position specific workout. Everybody worked out the same. You tested the same. So, I'm doing bench press and military shoulder press and just like the D and the forwards are doing. And so, that changed for me. I became, as I stuck around longer and longer, the fitness aspect changed and it became more position specific. And you didn't see goalies do the bench press anymore. It was about flexibility and, core strength and lower body strength and agility. And so that was probably the first thing. And then the second thing is I had to, and like I said earlier, that was back in the era when you could clutch and grab and I could be more aggressive. Well, then, that stuff got taken away in the early 2000s. And Dave Pryor, my old goalie coach, always told me, you can play as far out as you want, as long as you don't get beat on the back door. So, I was very aggressive at the time. And then once the clutching and grabbing all got taken out, I had to play back and be a little bit more conservative. And so what that did was, my tracking was always fairly good. But I had to track even better because I was giving up just a little bit more net than I did. And being more patient on my feet, not just automatically dropping all the time so that I'm not getting, beat up high. And so my game had to evolve that way. And I was always probably up until about a year or two before we got together in Tampa when I was in Washington, I was always a goalie that got up on the wrong foot. And Dave and I were always working on getting somewhere on your feet. So as opposed to goalies now, they drop down in a reverse VH and they're sliding back and forth on their knee and low plays. And that wasn't the game back then for me. I was getting post to post. I was coming top of the crease back down, low the far post, opposite side post on my feet. And for me, that worked. I don't know if that could work for me nowadays. The game is so fast and it's so east-west. I understand why there is a lot more time spent on the knees. And but having said that, if I was healthy and you talk about my health and for the most part I was healthy, but then those last 2 years I had a labral tear in my hip my last year in Washington, which meant I was basically I couldn't put any weight on my leg all summer that year before I came to Tampa, just so that I could be able to, put my body in that position again. And then, when I was in Tampa, shortly after the season started, I tore my biceps tendon. And so at that point for me, I knew I was done. My body was starting to really fall apart. And since then, within the last 6 years, I've had both my hips done. So like they're both metal hips. So it caught up with me later on in my career, but I did take very good care of myself during my career. Like I said, there was a lot of guys would crash the net and I would have, I had 225 pounds and
You could stand your ground
because of
pretty
the way I
easily.
worked out, because of the way I worked out like a forward or defenseman, I was pretty strong. And so if I did get run, I never put myself in a vulnerable position because I was able to kind of hold myself steady. And, but like I said, at the end of my career, it really started catching up with me. And, but yeah, you have to adapt. And I found that out. You find that out as a coach as well. Like you have to adapt. And, when we, not so much more when you first came in, but say 10, 15, 20 years before that, when I first came in, you had a coach and you had 20 players that had to adhere to the coach. So whatever the coach's style was, you had to adhere to that. Now, nowadays it's the opposite. The coach has to adjust to 20 personalities. And a certain way to coach a player does maybe not work for one guy. Like you could be, one guy needs to get a kick in the ass all the time in order for him to play his best. Another guy needs to be coddled. Some guys just are meant to be left alone. And so the game is always evolving. And as a player, you have to, or you see it now with a lot of forwards that, say 5, 10 years ago, they were power forwards. They're physical. They get in the corners. They stand in front of the net. but their skating wasn't that good. And now it's catching up with them. And so now these guys that were integral part of a team just really aren't effective on the ice anymore because, you know, they didn't work on their skating. They didn't work on their explosiveness. They're just, they're stuck in a game that, you know, that it worked for them 15, 20 years ago. So the guys that last the longest are always the ones that adapt the most.
I'm looking at your time that you spent with the Capitals, and to me, aside from it being a great career with one team, there's two seasons that really stand out, though. The first of which is 97-98 when you guys went to the Stanley Cup Finals, and the other one's 99-2000 when you won the Vezina. I'd like you to maybe compare and contrast those two seasons, because if you look at them on paper, I don't know which one of those I would consider to be a best season. And I'm curious for you which one you think, on a personal level, was more gratifying.
Oh, for me, it was the year we went to the finals. Because that was for me, that was the year that I broke out of being a backup and becoming a number one guy. And you know, I went to the Olympics that year in Nagano, playing the All-Star game. But the success I had in the playoffs was the biggest reason. Because the year I won the Vezina, we lost in the first round to Pittsburgh. And game one of that series, we lost 8-0.
Oof.
So I took a lot of solace, and I really, you know, because all the voting and everything is done before the playoffs start. And, you know, so you go to the award show, and yeah, you had a great year, but the thing that people remember is, you know, that first series against Pittsburgh, and you lost 8-0 in the first game. And so for me, that was a little. I was a little unsettled. I had a fantastic regular season, and but it just felt unsatisfying because of how it ended. But whereas in 97, 98, I had some ups and downs during the regular season, but from day one right through June when we lost to Detroit, yeah, to me personally, that was arguably my best year.
That had to be a pretty magical season. I'm just looking at some of the names that you had on the roster back then, from Bondra to Oates to Housley to Joey Juneau, Dale Hunter. What made that team so good aside from the skill level that you had? Because that's not what takes teams to the finals. It's not just skill. It takes other intangibles to get them there. What got your team to that level that you guys were playing for the Stanley Cup in the finals?
Timing, I think, was a little bit of it. You know, the teams I think Buffalo beat the teams that were ahead of us in the standings all got beat in the first and second round. The Flyers, the Devils, I'm trying to remember who else. But at the end of the day, you still have to beat everybody in order to win the thing. So, but if you look at in the names you just rattled off, you look at the guys that we had. We have a very intelligent hockey team. Craig Berube, right? At that time was a fourth line guy, tough guy, but what people didn't see is how much of a student he was of the game. He ends up winning the Stanley Cup this year as a coach for St. Louis. Dale Hunter, you know, third line center, tough as nails, character player, but you know, he had success as a coach in Washington, and then what he's done in London is phenomenal. Phil Housley, successful the USA program, maybe didn't go his way in Buffalo, but obviously, to get hired in the NHL, you have to have something between the ears. Same with Adam Oates, Calle Johansson, another guy, Sergei Gonchar, you know, assistant coach with Pittsburgh. So from that, and Bill Ranford, goalie coach for LA. So from that team, you know, you had a lot of very smart hockey guys, and maybe didn't look at it back then at that point, but then you see all the success they're having now, on the coaching or management side of things, and now you understand we had a very smart team.
Something I don't think a lot of people have ever asked about is what the NHL was like before and after the 04-05 lockout, that I've heard at least. And I want to get your opinion on it, how coming out of 2004, you know, your Washington team has Jaromír Jágr. You have a complete year off. The next time in 05-06, he's gone. Alexander Ovechkin comes in. What was the mood like in the locker room, not just for you guys, but really just around the league coming back from that full season off of hockey?
Me personally, I became very anti-union. I just felt we just didn't have a plan B. We gambled thinking that the owners, you know, were bluffing. And they obviously they weren't. And for me, that was the pinnacle of my earning power. I mean, that was the highest amount of money I was going to make as a player. And so for me, when I got back, I was bitter, very bitter. More so at the Union than the NHL itself, but I just like, this is, how do we survive this? I mean, first league that's ever, basically threw a whole season out the window, and we traded everybody and their dog. We're in total rebuild. I think in 03 we end up going, we end up finishing just behind Tampa. We lose to them in the first round. They go on to win the cup the next year, and we go into full sell-off mode, and everybody. And they even asked me if I wanted to get traded, and at that point I was like, I've been here my whole career. I don't want to go anywhere else.
But
And
that's such a tough role to be in as a goalie on a rebuilding team, 'cause you know you're going to get shelled every
well,
night.
yeah. Oh, of course. In hindsight, obviously now, it was. But this part of you thinks that you could be the answer,
Oh yeah, you got
and
that pride factor. You think for sure you
for
can be
sure.
part of the success here. Yeah, I totally understand that.
But it ended up being, it was a tough couple of years. Fortunately, we had a great group of guys. There was some guys that probably weren't shouldn't have been in the NHL at the time, but that's not their fault. And but they were we had a really tight group of guys. It wasn't like, there was bitching and complaining about losing and this and that. Everybody worked hard. We all kind of knew what was going on. It was the Alexander Ovechkin sweepstakes. We're, lack of a better word, they're hoping we were going to finish last. And so anyway, we ended up winning the lottery. We ended up, again, in hindsight, it couldn't have worked out any better for the organization. You got one of the most dominating players of his generation of the game ever. They eventually won a Stanley Cup. We eventually won a Stanley Cup. I'm sure it was probably a lot later than they initially expected to, but they sacrificed a couple of bad years, low attendance, to get to the point where we were at last June when we won in Vegas. So it was tough, especially I'd been on such a good run from the first time I established myself in 97, 98. And then to go through those 2 years, and then things were finally starting to look up. We made the playoffs against Philadelphia. And for me not to be there anymore after that season, it was kind of tough. And then I ended up coming down to Tampa, and I really, maybe the hockey wasn't what I expected it to be. It was a bit of a, you were there. It was a bit of
It's an interesting
a soap
season.
opera.
Yeah, from a lot of
Yeah, it was an
ways.
interesting season, but
I've never been on a team that actually changed payroll providers three times. That was a first for me.
it was, well, you had owners. One was living there. The other guy was in British Columbia, and
Right.
they didn't see eye to eye. And yeah, it was a bit of a soap opera. And but anyway, having said that, I mean, I'm glad I went down there. Hindsight, I probably A should have considered retiring after that last season in Washington. Because I ended up getting hurt first month in Tampa, and basically became, I think I was a part-time goalie coach and part-time party organizer. So,
Those aren't bad roles to be in, though. Those are pretty good
no,
jobs to
I
have.
know.
I was actually talking to Adam Hall today, and he was telling me how good you were about finding undercover bottles of wine, especially from the Washington area. So Adam Hall's really happy that he had
That's
you as a
funny.
teammate.
It's funny you brought his name up. He texted me here a couple of weeks ago. I hadn't heard from him in a while, so he was a great teammate. But it because of that, I ended up living 10 years down there after, and I made a bunch of friends, so the hockey wasn't great, but I made, once you leave the rink and it's 70 degrees in January, there's worse places to be, right? So anyway, it was a tough last 3 years of my career. I don't even know, maybe it's, I won a total of, oh God, I don't even know, 50 games, if that? Maybe not even 50. No, it wouldn't have been 50.
That's more than I have by a
Probably
long shot.
30 or
I
40 in my last three games.
tell you what, if I
Yeah, I
had
know, but you know what I
50,
mean. Like, you're coming on.
if I had 50 wins in the NHL, I'd be a lot happier than I am right now.
I know. You know what I mean? Like I was on such a good run,
Yeah, for sure.
and then all of a sudden, you go to that, and it just didn't leave a sour taste in my mouth. I still, hey, listen, they gave me the option. They asked me if I wanted to get traded. I said no. And then Father Time took over, and I started falling apart. But no, so it was tough. But you know what? I came back to the organization, and as a result, we ended up winning the Stanley Cup last year. So
Yeah, pretty good place to be in.
it wasn't too bad. Yeah.
No, man. Well, you touched on it. I mean, you had a young Alexander Ovechkin come in. So as a goaltender seeing him in practice, what was it like as an 18-year-old with him coming across? You know, is he much different than he is today? Could you always see that offensive flair from the first moment you're on the ice with him?
Oh yeah. God, I played against him. Actually, I was in during the lockout. I actually went to Germany and played the last part of the season in the DEL, and he was over there with his junior team. We didn't play against each other, but I saw him play, and I talked to him before our game, and I was like, wow, this kid is special. And then that next year training camp, when he first comes on the ice, and the thing with Ovi that I don't know if he gets enough credit for is how he was such a respectful guy when he came in as a stud 18-year-old. He wanted to learn. He wanted to room with a North American guy because he wanted to learn English right away. He was very respectful of people in practice.
That's what I wanted to know. Was he an absolute weapon in practice?
He was okay. I mean, he was okay. But then, like I said, once that comfort level set in and there was a rapport between us and there was almost like a competition between us, then his level turned up a notch. And there are a few times where he didn't score, but it left a nice bruise on my shoulder, or a nice ringing in my ears because it went off the side of my head.
Yeah.
And so we had a lot of fun those 2 years I played with him. It was no, the kid was special. And you know what? Nothing's really not a lot's changed with Ovi. I think last year it was a huge step in his leadership development. You could just see, and there was a reason why we won the cup. And it's all because of Ovi. He was blocking shots. He was, he was had guy had the young guys under his arm, and whether he was giving them crap or encouraging them, like you could just see he was so much more invested, and guys fed off that. And but the thing with Ovi was, the things that his first 2 years, the things that everybody loved about him was his enthusiasm, and it's just his love for the game and his celebrations. Now all of a sudden he becomes a big name, and now the same things that he was doing, he's getting vilified for. Like, I remember the game against Tampa where he scored, and I don't know if you remember it, but he was dropped his stick behind the net and he pretended it was like it was a fire.
I remember pretty well. It happened 10 feet behind me. I was the one he scored it on.
Oh, were you the one?
See, this is the reaction you
Yeah,
get
okay,
every
so.
single time. You're the guy he did the hot stick to? Yeah, that was me. And then Don Cherry defended my dignity on Hockey Night in Canada.
Well, that's when that's when Ovi started getting more haters than
Right.
lovers,
Yeah.
and I'm sure grapes didn't help with that. But
Yeah, but look how he played in the playoffs this year. I mean, he was eating shots left and right, total team commitment. You know, like you can throw all this stuff when you're younger under the bridge because people learn as they get older, and it's when you're
yeah.
young and enthusiastic and exuberant, sometimes you just don't think about things. I've been guilty of that. A lot of people have. You know, that's normal when you're a young player.
Right. No, but what I'm saying is that he was the same way, but because of the success he was getting, and he's Russian, and now he was getting vilified for his exuberance and his celebrations, and whereas before we all cherished it because oh, here's this young kid from Russia, look how excited he is, and then but he has definitely matured from that. He's more of a, when he scores now, they're not nearly as exuberant. I don't know if it's age and he's wants to save his energy or what, but he's definitely more mature, and yeah, he played great again this year for us. He just didn't get any he didn't get any secondary help like he did last year. Where everybody contributed, and there was only a couple three guys that really stepped up for us in the playoffs this year.
Let's roll this back a little bit here because you talked about Byron Defoe, and I didn't get a chance about the ask about the relationship that you have with him. From what I've gathered, you were best men at each other's weddings. You've had several on-ice fights. Your previous teammates. There's an awful lot going on there. Can you just describe the dynamic you have between both of you guys?
So we were both drafted, and we played against each other in tier two and in the Western Hockey League. And at the time, you know, Byron was a pretty highly touted goalie. You know, going into that draft, the preseason, you know, he was him and a couple other guys throughout the CHL were, you know, going to be the top picks. And I had a really break. I had a breakout year that year in junior. And you know, here's this kid. He's 6'3". You know, takes up a lot of net. And so all of a sudden, I became more relevant in the picture. And so every time Byron and I'd play, he just had this arrogance about him. It just absolutely drove me nuts. And you know, lo and behold, the season ends, and you know, we're both at the draft, and I ended up getting picked first by Washington, and I'm doing my backstage interviews and everything, and then all of a sudden I hear, and in the second round, the Washington Capitals are proud to select Byron Defoe, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. So
My
here
arch
I am at the
rival.
time. I couldn't, my arch rival, couldn't stand the guy, arrogant, yada yada yada. So that's that training camp. You know, like I said, we were the only two rookies that would end up going to Russia for training camp with the team. And I remember the first, so we just got over. We started in Sweden, spent a week in Sweden. And I remember we got off the plane, and the coach says, guys, don't go to sleep. Just try to stay up as long as you can. We're going to go on the ice here in a couple hours. And so we went to the hotel. And yeah, it was tough. It was tough not to go to sleep, but you didn't. So we got to the rink, and I got there. And we're going on the ice, and I'm like, where's Byron? Well, him and his roommate went to sleep. So we're about 30 minutes into practice, and Byron, and I'm trying to think who his roommate was. And they end up, it was John Drews. It was John Drews. And they're in their gear, they're at the door ready to get on the ice. And Brian Murray was a coach at the time, said, I don't think so, boys. Go in there and take your gear off. So right then I'm like, yes, I must step up on the guy. Good. I can't stand him. I love it. Couldn't happen to a better guy. Anyway, the trip goes on, you know, we're the two rookies. So we start to hang around a little bit more. And we realize we both got a lot of similar interests. You know, we're both living in British Columbia. So anyway, after the 2-3 week training camp over there, we came back over, and from that point on, we were best of friends. You know, we played that year against each other in the Western League again, played each other in the playoffs. And then back then, because the divisions were unbalanced, the Western division of the Western League had less teams than the East. The teams in the West would play best of nines. So we played Portland in a best of nine series. I think we lost in seven, but moving forward, you know, we got together training camp again. The next year, he came back to junior. It's my first year pro. The time we spent together in Baltimore, we roomed together. We ended up buying an investment property in Scottsdale that kind of it was our off-season place. We hung out. We didn't have any serious girlfriends or anything at the time, so we just did a lot of stuff.
So
And then
Scottsdale made
eventually, we
sense
both,
back
you know.
then.
Oh, well, yeah, not in the middle of summer, but it was still fun. You know, we ended up getting serious with two women, and I got married first in 98. He was my best man, and then he got married a little bit later in 98, and I was his best man. And then we both became godparents to each other's boys, and yeah, so it was an interesting start. And then, like you said, we won a Calder Cup together in Portland. And then I remember it was the year after we went to the finals, 98, 99, might have been in November. We were playing the Bruins, and they came out hard. We were down 2-3 nothing 7 minutes into the game. And so our coach throws out Mark Tenorti, Dale Hunter, Craig Berube, Chris Simon. So you kind of knew what was going to happen. And the puck drops, and Craig Berube goes after Don Sweeney in the corner. And the next thing you know, it's just a melee. And then Dale Hunter gets squared off with Jesse Bélanger, who was a tough guy back then for them. And so I'm Hunt's getting into it with him, and I like, okay, I came out and started helping Hunt's. I threw my gloves down and came out and was helping Hunt's. And then next thing I know, I got this guy on my back. I turn around, and it's Byron. And so we square off. We grab each other's shoulder, and we just couldn't throw a punch. It was the weirdest thing. Couldn't throw a punch. And we're sitting there, and then we just kind of wrestled back and forth, and we started going. We were right by the Boston bench, and in not so nice of terms, they basically said, "Would you two idiots stop smiling and start throwing them?" And then Byron just got a little bit of a surge, and he grabbed my jersey and pulled it over my head, and I said, "Byron, don't you do it! Don't you do it!" And to his credit, he didn't do it. And so anyway, the fight got broken up. We got kicked out of the game. And so that summer, he came down here, and topic conversation came up. We were with a group of friends, and somebody asked, "So who ended up winning that fight?" And I said, "Well, nobody really did." I said, "But if I wanted to, I could have taken him down, no problem." And then Byron pulls out the front. It was the front page of the Boston Globe, and he clipped the front page out, and he goes, "Well, I don't know, guys. What do you think?" And it was the picture. It was the exact moment the jersey was over my head, and he had his fist cocked. Oh, he carried it around with him everywhere he went because he knew it would come up, and so he always wanted the proof. So we ended up calling it was called the dance because not one punch was thrown, and even the commentators were making they were best men at each other's weddings, and so yeah, I don't. But we remain really close friends. Both our sons, suffer with autism, and so we've done a lot of stuff in the autism community, and we see each other every summer. We go up to Kelowna for a week at a time and spend time with the family, and we go on vacations together. So, that relationship really, if you would have told me in 87 that we would have been, or sorry, 80, 89, that we were going to be best of friends, and now this lifelong bond, I would have said, "You got to be crazy." And now here we are.
Hockey does funny things to people. Away from the rink, you are
Yes, it
also
does.
known for your community work. You were honored for that on several occasions. And like you just alluded to, a lot of that relates to the Carson Kolzig Foundation, who is your son. So maybe if you could go into a little bit what you guys do with the foundation, with Athletes Against Autism that you're also involved with, just what you've done with that away from the rink.
Yeah, so I mean, I've always been a person that knows that what we do is special. You're getting paid a lot of money to play a game, but you also realize that you can have an influence in what you're doing. You can have an influence on people, and so I was always involved with Children's Hospital in DC, and any kind of kids charity, I was always involved in. I just felt that being sick and being a kid just shouldn't go hand in hand, and this was long before my son was born. And so my son was born in 2001, and 15 months after that, he went in for a regular checkup, and the doctor noticed some things, and he was very educated in the world of autism, which back then not many doctors were, and so we were fortunate in that aspect. And after the appointment, he told my wife that he thinks we should go to the Children's Hospital and get a professional diagnosis because he thinks that my boy has autism. And so that rocked our world. We were devastated, and but we became proactive right away on what how can we help him? And you find out. I got introduced to so many people. Scott Mellenby was one of the first people I called. My good friend Stu Barnes was close with Scotty, and Scotty had a boy who was diagnosed with autism, and so he kind of helped me through the first part. And he didn't sugarcoat it. He said that, "I'm not going to lie to you. It's going to be hard. It's a hard road." And but this is, and he kind of gave us a guideline on where to start. And you find out later that getting the diagnosis is a nightmare, but then having the resources, you go online and you see, like, it's mind-boggling all the things that are out there, and not everything works for every kid. It's a combination of certain things that work for certain kids, and so we were able to get our boy on the right program, and then You find out too that the first 5 years is the most vital for brain development, and because our doctor had diagnosed him so early, we had, we had a good 3.5 years to kind of retrain his brain or direct it a little bit different. So, we were fortunate, and my son, obviously, he's a high functioning, and will probably live with us for the rest of his life, but because of the help we got for these people, he's going to live a much better life. And so shortly after that, about a year after Carson got diagnosed, Eric, my godson, Byron's son, was finally diagnosed. Kim and Byron at the time had thought there was always something that wasn't quite right with Eric, but they didn't have the doctor that I had, that, they wasn't educated in autism. They just didn't know what was going on. And so they missed out on a year. But, again, once they got the diagnosis, they got put, I helped them, Scott helped them. And so Eric got the necessary treatment, and now he's a very high functioning individual. And because of that, the three of us got together and decided that, how can we take this to a national level? And so that's when we started Athletes Against Autism, AAA. And you know what? And people were like, well, why are you calling it against autism? And it should be for autism. And, at the time, it was more about the AAA aspect. Like that's some sort of professional, a AAA level or whatever. So it just had a sports tie-in, and athletes for autism, AFA, just probably didn't fit. So anyway, we started AAA. We had a couple of very successful fundraisers, golf outings for about 3, 4 years, raised some significant money. And then the downturn in the economy came, and we were branched off of Autism Speaks. And, unfortunately, with the downturn of the economy, money giving isn't quite there as it used to be. So, those foundations had to cut back as well. And so we were one of the first branches that got cut because we were one of the new ones. But because of the establishment of that group, we were able actually to bring in Ernie Els. Ernie had been a little bit reluctant on announcing, that his boy had autism, but he finally came out, and we brought him in on into the fold. And the good thing is that even though AAA disbanded, Ernie stayed on with Autism Speaks and is a huge advocate, and he's opened up a center in West Palm Beach. And him and his wife have done a tremendous amount of stuff for the autism world. So again, you're getting a group of people together, and they can make some sort of a significant impact on society. And now living in Tri-Cities, back then, we ended up opening or starting the Carson Kolzig Foundation, and it was more generated to, central Washington and kind of where we lived in Tri-Cities. And, we had a bunch of yearly golf outings called the Desert Bash that Stu Barnes and myself would host. Eventually, Carey Price was a part of it. We haven't had one for 2 years. Probably going to start up again, not this year, but next year again, now that I'm back here full time. But we, over the course, we probably raised about 1.2 million. And because of that, we were able to help fund, it's called a Responding to Autism Center. And so what would take place there is that if there are parents that think their child is on a spectrum, there's educated people there that have certificates to give formal diagnosis. And so they come in for screening and would be said, yes, we think he's on the spectrum, and then they would be guided out from there, so that the nightmare of getting on the computer and trying to find resources, like what I myself and Byron had to go through, isn't there. Where we're trying to, we're that guideline for them, and we made connections with doctors in town here. We had several conferences each summer, where the autism world would get together, and we'd bring in guest speakers, and we would have breakout sessions where physicians would be better educated on autism, how to, what to look for, so that, kids are diagnosed at an earlier age, so that you can get that vital retraining of the brain in the first 5 years. And so it's been, and people ask me, what's the biggest accomplishment, or what's the most thing that you cherish most about being, you know, about your time in the NHL? And I mean, obviously last year was special, winning the Stanley Cup. I didn't do it as a player, but, you know, as a player, I think winning the King Clancy Award for, you know, for your leadership off and on the ice and, you know, what you do in the community, because, you know, at the end of the day, your stats and all this stuff, you know, records will be broken, yada, yada, yada. But what you do as a man, in my opinion, is what you're going to be remembered for the most. And so that award, you know, people thought to give that to me really, really meant the world to me. And my dad had passed away that April, and I had the awards ceremony in June. And I remember up on the stage, I sort of choked up because, you know, my dad should be here because he's the big reason why, you know, I have this trophy. And I think he'd just be so proud to know of, you know, type of man that he raised. And so, yeah, I think players, people, you have to understand that, you know, you do work hard, but you are a very fortunate individual and that you are playing a game. You're getting paid very well. And the importance of giving back and the impact it has on society and in the community is vital. And I hope more and more players feel that way.
Think about how many people you've helped over the years. It's a completely selfless thing to do. I'm really happy to hear you share that with everyone, too, because I hope it sets a precedence that I think a lot of guys get it, but every time you hear it, it helps reinforce it. So I've got one last question I've got to ask for you, though. I need to know if you still have that beautiful blue, gold, and black set of gear made by Heaton, your Dylan mask with Godzilla on it from, I believe, 1998, because it's one of the greatest sets of gear ever produced. Do you still have it?
I don't have it, and I do. I actually, that was probably my favorite model Heaton pads. They broke in the way you wanted to. And here's another real interesting fact. I know we're running out of time, but so Brian Heaton and I were the first duo. Like, I wore Heaton's when I was playing junior in Tri-Cities, and I came up with the very first illusion pattern for a pad. And all it was half a triangle on each pad. So when your pads are put together, it looks like it's a black triangle.
That was you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Brian and I both. Yep.
Never
so
knew
anyway, we were really big into the images. And the year after the finals, that those pads, I came out the next and I had the it was a black, blue, and then it had like the copper stars.
Yep.
That were stitched on. So no, we were really, we really came up with some pretty cool ideas. But no, I wish I still had those pads. I love those things.
God, they were beautiful. And that mask too. You were one of the last guys still wearing a Dylan mask, and the paint job on it was iconic. And I think that's part of the reason why you were always one of my favorite goalies too, is just because you had this unbelievably cool looking gear. And nowadays it's so generic. Everybody just wears white equipment and everybody looks and plays the same. And it kind of bums me out. And that's why.
It's true. It is true. There's a lot more personality back then. And I think because that style of gear was just starting to come out where you could be a little bit more creative, people came up with some pretty cool ideas. And now everything's kind of run its course, and goalies are more about, I think they're more about the illusion. And obviously the gear's been cut down a little bit. So, you know, it says white gear you look bigger in, and so more guys than not are wearing white gear.
It's just the way it goes. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
No problem, Mac. Anytime.
Thanks for listening to 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna. Please make sure that you like, comment, leave a rating, subscribe, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere that you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.